Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy Wince-Free Whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for two shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White. A whiter smile without the wince.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick VinZant. Coming up in this episode, the art of turkey calling and the best birds.
But that's your yelp. That's essentially like a people saying hi. You have basically fooled the ears of some of the most critical judges, and you're on the other side of that curtain, a mere feet away often, and you're fooling them to thinking that you're a turkey. I started this stuff when I was a college kid. You don't get much broker than college. I did that and took off across the country, living out of the back of my truck, sleeping on a cot. As funny as it sounds, turkeys themselves have put me in places that I would have never seen had it not been for turkeys. I've done things in my life that I never thought was obtainable, and it's all due to turkeys.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, subscribe. Leave us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. If you're a longtime listener, thank you so much for all of your support. So our first guest is one of the best turkey callers in the world. And what's so interesting to me about turkey calling, it's not just making some sounds, trying to get the attention of the turkey. It's having a conversation with the turkey. It's fascinating. This is turkey call champion Dave Owens. What is the importance of having like a turkey call? Why do you need this? Where does this come from?
Well, the calling aspect of turkey hunting is kind of the defining factor. That's what kind of makes it different, because we have a communication with our prey. We are able to carry on a conversation, carry on a dialogue. What we're essentially trying to do is enter their flock, convince them that we are one of the flock, and convince them to come investigate for one reason or another. So the calling aspect is what makes it different. It's extremely important, because without it, turkey hunting would just blend with any other type of spot and stalk or the sit and wait kind of games that you get in with oftentimes with big game hunting. The calling is very important because it sets it apart and kind of what gives turkey hunting in itself a different feel. And I think that's what is the big fascination for most of us that are just obsessed with it. That's kind of what gives it that draw.
So like when you're doing the call, you're not just like, hey, turkeys, come here. Like you're going back and forth with them.
It's like any other conversation, like the one that we're having here now. I mean, they have a whole, vocabulary. I mean, you can get excited. You could do subtle stuff. It's no different than saying, hey, how you doing, Nick? And hey, Nick, how's it going? Like you just learn over time how to the dialects and the different, the excitement levels and what to say. I mean, they have a couple off the top, like the most standard turkey sound is a yelp. It's what everything else is kind of developed around and kind of builds off of. You have cutting, which is a very excited sound, which typically means aggression or excitement of some level. You have purring, which can be a contented call, which is what they do when they're just, just kind of subtle talk, because, like you would do if you were, in your office chatting with a coworker while you were, doing something else. But that same purring sound can also get aggressive, because that's what they do when they're fighting. It's almost like when you're fighting and you're grunting and growling and whatever, it can be, to that level. So as you can quickly probably gather, the calling is a big part, and it a lot of layers to it.
Could you give us an example of like those, what the calls sound like?
I got one right here. This is what I'd use a lot. There's a lot of different kind of calls, but this is what you call a mouth call or a Yelper diaphragm call. It's essentially an aluminum frame that's below this tape. This tape is kind of like, to explain it, it would be kind of like medical tape that you would, you know, wrap a bandage or something with. And it's got an aluminum frame in it, and this is latex that's stretched between that aluminum frame, and you blow air across it, and you get vibrations off the ends. There's a lot of different cut configurations that you can use to get different sounds. And probably the most universal call, you can use the mouth calls to do a little bit of everything. And but there's also pot and peg type calls. There's box calls. I was going to see if I had one of those laying around here, and I don't. Basically it's just different instruments, just like musical instruments. You got horns and guitars and drums. I mean, it's the same thing with turkey calls. You got different things that can kind of make the same sounds, but they all have their strengths and weaknesses. The mouth calls, you can obviously tell it's very small. You put it in your mouth, you can still hold your firearm or whatever else you may have in your hands that you may not have available if you were having to run like a box call, which is another instrument you can use during turkey calling. But I'll demonstrate it, but you caught me off guard here, so let me.
Yeah, like I didn't give him a chance to really do something, so like.
Like anything else, you got to loosen it up. It's like a guitar player that's going to, you know, strum the strings and set tune his guitar and everything. Nothing's different with turkey calls, and we'll try to rush this. But the Yelp that I just explained or just kind of hinted to. I don't know how that comes across with the audio on these earbuds and in the machine here, but that's your Yelp. That's essentially like a people saying hi or hey or where are you. You can take that to so many different levels. It could be a curiosity deal. It could be a demanding deal. And it's all going to be with the personality that you want to put behind that hen, the voice that you want to give the hen that you're trying to portray. It's going to be hard to do cutting. It's going to peak the audio, but we can do clucking is more or less, it's a dress up word in the turkey world that you kind of, it can be contented. It's kind of one of those things that turkeys are going to be doing all the time. And so you do the clucking, it kind of dresses it up. It's almost like I would explain it as, I mean, kind of like an adjective in human vocabulary. It's going to help add personality. It's going to help detail the noun that you're trying to explain and the point you're trying to get across. Other sounds that we just hinted to are like the purr, which can be very contented. It's the sound that turkeys are going to make when they're congregated and they're feeding. They're just being content. And all these sounds are just made by putting air across this latex and these reeds and vibrations that you make with your throat, with your tongue, and causing those sounds to come across there to mimic a turkey.
I can't believe, how did people figure this out? Like, to me, looking at it from the outside of it, I assumed that, like, all right, you make a couple sounds, the turkeys come down and you take them out. I did not realize that was that in depth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it isn't, there's turkey calling competitions. We do it competitively. I mean, you are obviously judged by men, so you're not judged by a turkey per se, but it's all on the realism that we can put into turkey calling and how realistic we can be using these devices, who can sound the best. There is so many layers and you can get so deep on trying to be perfect. Just like anything else, you just work and work and work and try to polish your sounds to be as realistic as possible. And when it, you know, that's going to obviously be good when you're competing against others. But once you take those talents into the woods, when you're actually hunting turkeys, the more realistic you can sound, the more you're going to be able to obviously mimic what you're trying to trying to replicate in the wild and fool more turkeys.
But will you like blow a hunt because you messed up a sound, right? Like I had them right where I wanted, and then I made the cluck when I should have made the cut, and the turkeys were gone.
No, it's not a hard and fast situation like that, just like we have in human vocabulary. I mean, if you and I are talking and I say a word that's out of place, or my voice cracks, or I have to get a drink of water because I get cotton mouth, same thing happens with turkeys. So I won't say it's impossible, but I will say it's quite difficult if you've got a turkey's attention and you're having a conversation to really just say something out of place. Now, you know, if you flip a reed, which is something that we refer to in the turkey calling world, like you have these latex reeds that I just talked about, and they do have a tendency of one of the tongues flipping backwards and sticking onto itself like so, that just comes out as squeaks. I mean, it's like popping a guitar string. You obviously can't strum the guitar when the guitar strings are gone. Same way. So if something like that happens, yeah, sure, you could run one off because it's going to sound like you got something caught in a trap. You know, it's going to squeal and squall and you could run them off that way. But fortunately, just like with people, turkeys have different voices. They have different enunciations. So there's a lot of flexibility when it comes to creating turkey sounds.
But why? So then what are you doing on the other end of it in the sense that, like, eventually, even if you're making all these great sounds, right, like, doesn't the turkey expect to see another turkey?
Absolutely. And you're hunting turkeys, which are hunted by everything 365 days a year. You're hunting the most paranoid critter out there. I mean, they are hunted from the air. They're hunted from the ground. They're hunted all the time. So what you're trying to do is convince them to trust their second most important sense. They live and die by their eyes. That is how they stay safe, is their eyesight is incredible. So what you're trying to do is get them to trust their ears enough to second guess their eyesight. That's the whole draw to turkey hunting. You are really trying to put a turkey in a position to where he is so convinced that you have convinced him by his ears through auditory effects that he almost second guesses his eyesight. You know, he's going to put his main line of defense that he has lived with and it has trusted his whole life, and he's kind of going to put that on the shelf because you've convinced him to trust his ears. So that's the big draw. That's the big pull to me, is kind of taking something that has absolutely, and you're hunting turkeys, which are hunted by everything 365 days a year. You're hunting the most paranoid critter out there. I mean, they are hunted from the air. They're hunted from the ground. They're hunted all the time. So lived in the wild, you know, and been hunted by everything and convincing it to that you're one of them. So
now are you a female turkey trying to lure a male? Male turkey trying to lure a female, like, or how does that usually?
Typically, I mean, just to be the stereotypical thing is, yes, you're a hen, you're a female turkey, you're trying to replicate, like, you know, a turkey wanting company. It's breeding season. That's why we most often hunt them during the spring. And exactly. You're just trying to lure the gobbler, which is the male turkey, into shotgun range or archery range by mimicking, you know, his desire to breed. So
the range that you would be looking to try to get them close, obviously it depends on the firearm, right? But mm-hmm. Like, what's the ideal? I want to get them within 500 yards. I want to get them within 5 feet.
Yeah, I mean, the standard answer here is going to be typically most people are hunting them with shotguns, which is, you know, more of a shorter range weapon. Because turkeys, you typically shoot them in the head and neck area because that's what's most lethal, it's most ethical. And that's something that's very seldom steal. If you've watched a turkey, their head is always moving because they rely on their eyesight. They're constantly tilting their head to get a better view. They can see like 320 degrees around them. So unless you're directly behind them, they can still see you moving. So we shoot them with shotguns at close range. Typically that's going to be 40 yards and in, which is kind of that standard. Advancements in shot and things of that nature may extend that range a little bit, but you will find that in the turkey hunting crowd, there's a lot of ethics that are self-imposed. I mean, there's a lot of us out there in the community that, although we may have the ability to take a turkey at extreme ranges or something may be quote unquote legal, you mightn't get in trouble for it. You're not breaking any laws, but we kind of just put things into place because we want to play this game that we are essentially playing. We want to self-impose some restrictions so that we can get the most enjoyment out of the resources possible.
You know, that's one thing I think we should jump into fairly quickly, right? Like some people, I grew up in Kansas and my general experience has been there's very few people who are as good as stewards of the land as hunters are. Do you ever get a lot of pushback? Is there pushback in the hunting community that like, why are you doing this? That kind of thing.
Not in the hunting community. I mean, we know we're brothers in arms. I think we're all on the same team and we understand that we have to be because we are a minority in the human population. I mean, hunters make up a fragment of the population. But what I will say, the wildlife populations that we're all able to enjoy, whether you're a hunter or not, is because of hunters, hunters and shooters. We're the ones that foot the bill and we're happy to do so. We have self-imposed taxes that we put into place. You know, we enjoy the populations, we're the first ones, like right now, for instance, a lot of your turkey populations have seen, reintroductions, and starting in about 2000, a lot of the areas that turkeys were reintroduced, they basically, fulfilled all the carrying capacity of the land. So basically their populations were just climbing exponentially there for a while. And now they were starting to see them plateau, maybe even dip a little bit before they plateau, which is pretty standard when you introduce a species. And a lot of turkey hunters, louder than anybody else, is on the horn saying, hey, you know, our turkey populations aren't what they were 10 years ago. It's time to put some additional regulation into place. It's time to kind of dial back to make sure that we have this resource for many generations. Hunters are the people that are doing that. Hunters are the people who are excited about making sure that these animals are here for years to come. So
when you go to the competition aspect of it, what makes one call better than another? Like how competitive is that arena?
It's very competitive. You have different divisions because like the calls that I was explaining earlier, you have the mouth calls like this, and that's an air operated call. It's obviously operated with air. You have a certain number of calls that are operated through friction, and that's the pot and peg calls that have like a slate surface or a glass surface. And you have a wooden peg that you scrape against that surface, and it makes a sound that replicates a turkey. And that's a friction call. So you have a division devoted strictly to friction. You have an open division, which is open to anything. But essentially, regardless of what kind of instrument you're using, the whole idea is to be as realistic as possible. You're judged by a panel of judges who are behind a curtain or under the stage. So they don't know who's calling in most situations, and they're judging strictly off what they're listening to and what is most closely, you know, resembles the sounds of a hen turkey.
So is it a hard thing to do, or is it a hard thing to do well?
Making the sounds of a turkey are not a very difficult thing to do. To make the sounds of a turkey that are extremely realistic can be very difficult. I mean, it's like with anything else, you know, we can, you know, with a little bit of practice, you can teach an 8-year-old to toss a ball up in the air and hit it with a bat. To go to the big leagues and get into the Hall of Fame takes a considerable amount of practice and effort to become that skilled at that. So same way with turkey calling. I mean, as far as picking up a call and making a sound that can sound somewhat like a turkey and probably fool a turkey, not difficult at all to get on the big stage and fool human ears and, you know, consistently fool turkeys. It's considerably more difficult.
So correct me if I'm wrong here. You got second place in the most recent national competition?
Yeah. There's a lot of turkey calling competitions across the country. We're trying to get the popularity of that built back up. It's not quite what it was in the early 90s when the turkey populations were peaking, as a matter of fact. It was popular. Everybody was doing it. Turkey calling competitions got popular. And they're coming back. We're seeing a lot more involvement than we used to. But yes, the big one, I guess you would call it the Super Bowl of turkey calling, is the Grand Nationals. It's held at the National Wild Turkey Federation, their national convention in Nashville, Tennessee. And they have the big Grand National Turkey Calling Competition. And yes, last year I placed second. And the year prior I placed second. And then the year prior, I mean, yeah, it's been a fun little run. But yeah, that's the most recent finishes.
So putting kind of all humbleness aside, I guess, for you, like, why did you place second? In the sense that, like, what are you doing that makes you better than other people? But what did the person who won do that, like, you didn't?
It's all when you get to that stage, you have basically they cut down all the callers in the country down to 13. There's 13 callers that go across the finals stage. Just making that stage is a huge accomplishment. Basically, you're one of the best. You have basically fooled the ears of some of the most critical judges, some judges that are behind the curtain that know turkeys, that have 20, 30, 40, 50 years of turkey hunting experience. So they know what a turkey sounds like. And you're on the other side of that curtain, a mere feet away often, and you're fooling them to thinking that you're a turkey. So basically they judge you on a scale from 1 to 20. And if they basically think that there was a turkey on the other side of that curtain, they're going to give you a 20. If they think you were almost a turkey, but there was a few things in there that, they'll give you 18, 19, you know? So basically they're all judged, and there's anywhere from 5 to 7 judges, and they'll total the points, and, they claim the winner. As far as what I'm doing, it's once you get to that stage, everybody up there is so good and so polished. It's splitting hairs. You know what I mean? It's really competitive. You always try to do something that's a little bit unique that may perk the ears of the judges that maybe the guy next to you is not. And of course, you're just trying to have a clean run. You're trying not to slip and make one of those unrealistic sounds. You try not to flip reeds on your call. You try not to let a peg slip on your surface. You're trying to be as much a wild turkey as you possibly can.
So is it more for kind of personal competition reasons or necessarily, or is this like something like you can make some money doing this?
Whew, it's hard to make money in this. I mean, it's definitely out of passion. It's definitely out of an obsession with turkey hunting. Turkey hunting is what got me to wanting to do competition calling, because it's going to make you a better turkey hunter. It makes you practice on your call more. It makes you more proficient on your call. And all of that's going to translate into being able to communicate with turkeys better.
How often a day, or how many hours a day, or a week, or whatever, like how much will you practice?
That's all going to be dependent on the caller themselves. A lot of these guys practice a number of hours a day. A lot of folks have jobs that they can practice when they're on the clock, so to speak. I know I got a good friend who operates heavy machinery, and he's up there. And he said he keeps a mouth caller in his mouth all the time. He's up there by himself. So he's just, you know, practicing and getting new sounds and working. For me personally, I practiced quite a bit when I was trying to kind of find my sound and kind of figure out what I wanted to do. But once I have found a lot of practice doesn't exactly do favors for me, because I pick up bad habits anything else. I don't practice that much now. I don't practice, you know, it's more just making sure I have the right equipment, making sure I have the right call. And because we make a ton of calls, because no two calls are the same. You've got to find just that right, you know, everybody has their favorite, you know, everybody has their favorite guitar if you're a musician. And just like turkey callers, we have our favorite calls. And typically everybody builds their own calls. And so now the practice for me now is usually breaking in new calls and trying to find that right call to have on game day.
So I Googled some stuff, right? And you were described as the best turkey hunter alive. Now
it's pretty subjective, considering that you don't keep score at this game, you know? I never, and I don't think anybody that turkey hunts and considers themselves a big turkey hunter would ever like be gunning for that accolade. I don't think anybody really wants that title, because the guys who really love this stuff, I would much rather be known as like an ambassador for the sport, somebody that wanted to see turkey hunting popular, wanted to see turkey hunting done in the right way, and wanted to be a champion for the resource, wanted to see that tomorrow there's more turkey hunters than there was. I mean, turkey hunters and turkeys as there was yesterday. So that's what I hope that when I'm dead and gone, and when the Penhodie Project's, seen its final sunset, I hope that people can look back on it and go, the guy loved turkeys and he wanted more turkeys and he wanted everybody to enjoy what he enjoyed, because as funny as it sounds, turkeys themselves have put me in places that I would have never seen had it not been for turkeys. I've done things in my life that I never thought was obtainable. And it's all due to turkeys. And I just had the fear. I'll just always hear these. You always hear it, when I retire, or one day I'm going to do that. When I retire, I'm going to do this. And I just had a fear much younger, hearing horror stories, that, man, you don't ever know if that day is going to come. So I've always looked at, man, if it was possible, then I was going to try to obtain it. And that's kind of the way I learned early on with this turkey hunting thing, that that's what I love to do. That's what I wanted to be good at. And I worked and just out of passion. It's not like when you say you worked, it's not like a professional sport where you got to go run wind sprints. It's not, it's almost involuntary. Your passion is so strong that you're going to get out there and do it either way. You're going to get out there and do it because you love it. And that's kind of what I've fallen into, is just strictly a passion that's caused me to love this stuff as much as I do. And it's, like I said, it's provided me with so much that I just think, man, if there's somebody that never is exposed to this, this could potentially have such a profound effect on them just as it did me. But if they're never exposed to it, how would they ever know? So that's why I thought it was a really good idea to start making it available for folks, putting out content that they could find and see how it had affected me and how more fulfilled I am as a person in life just because of wild turkeys and wild things, wild places, and getting to go. I've traveled to all 49 states that have a huntable turkey population. I've hunted turkeys in all 49 states. There's no way I would have ever went to Rhode Island or Delaware or, Nevada. I mean, these places are just, I'm just a guy from Southeast. I'm happy being in the Southeast. I'm a Georgia, Florida, Alabama. That's kind of where I like to do my thing. But this attraction to want to experience wild turkeys and all over the country has put me in these places, and I've seen things and had experiences that, man, I'm just, every time I do, I think there's somebody out there that won't ever see this. And, exposing them to wild turkeys, maybe they will. So that's my place.
What's Hawaii is the one state that doesn't? I'm assuming it's got to be Hawaii, right?
No, it's Alaska. Hawaii actually has a lot of turkeys.
Really?
Absolutely. Yep.
How the hell did they get to Hawaii and not to Alaska?
They don't have, Alaska, see, turkeys function on a photo period, like the length of day. That's how they know when it's time to breed. That's how they know when it's not. There's the length of day. And if you aware, Alaska has a point of time where it's daylight all the time and dark all the time. So turkeys can't deal with that. They function off the photo periods. Hawaii's actually got a ton of turkeys because they don't have any natural predators like we do in the continental U.S. Turkeys have a lot of predators here. Like I mentioned earlier, they're hunted by everything. Everything eats a turkey. But in Hawaii, there's very few. I think they have like a weasel or something that's a predator. And that's about the only thing. So their turkeys out there are plentiful.
Man, those are great. That was a great sentiment that you put before I asked that dumb question about which is, but that's all I could think of. It's just like, man, which state is it? It had to be Hawaii. But like, when you go out there, do you have an overall strategy, or is it just kind of whatever nature gives you?
Yeah. I mean, hunting turkeys, whether you're doing it from South Florida to, Washington, from sea to shining sea, it's pretty similar. You're doing the whole dialogue. It's the whole conversation thing. And you're trying to replicate a hen turkey most of the time and trying to look to fool a turkey into thinking that he's coming up there to breed. So all of that's pretty much the same. It's just the topography, the terrain changes, and that's what makes it attractive to battle with turkeys across the country, because you never know what's around the next corner when you're on unfamiliar ground. And I think that's the that's the draw to a lot of us that travel to turkey hunt like I do, is wanting to experience something familiar in an unfamiliar place. And turkeys gives you the ability to do this somewhat on a budget. You know, if you're an elk hunter or even a deer hunter, the cost of entry is pretty steep a lot of times. I mean, your tag cost is $500-$800, over $1,000 sometimes. The access to property that may have these animals is pretty limited sometimes. Turkeys are pretty affordable. I've kind of prided myself and kind of built a reputation on doing everything on a budget, just trying to be in a, you know, I started this stuff when I was a college kid. You don't get much broker than college kids, you know what I mean? Eating ramen noodles and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I did that and took off across the country, living out of the back of my truck, sleeping on a cot, and just living out of a cooler. You know, we would take off, and the only thing we would have in the whole trip was the cost of tags. You can typically get turkey tags for around $200 or less. And you can go out there and hunt, and you can live out of the back of your truck, eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and have the experiences of a life. And, you know, you have less than $1,000 in this thing. And it's hard to find any – it's hard to find that much fun for that little bit of money.
Now, where does turkey hunting rank? Like, okay, this in terms of like, all right, this is the most popular, this is second. Like, where is turkey hunting kind of in the pecking order, if I can?
It's all going to depend on your region. You know, turkey hunting is not nearly as popular out on the west side. You know, on the west side, it's big game. It's elk, antelope, mule deer, whitetail. You know, mountain lion, you know, that kind of stuff's really big out west. And then across the country, whitetail deer are going to be king. I mean, whitetail deer, just the amount of people that hunt whitetail deer, the amount of money it generates for the states is huge. In the southeast, it's probably still going to be whitetail deer, but in the southeast, turkeys are a very close second. It's almost a religion down here. Turkey hunting is pretty sacred down here. I mean, we have you'll come down here and you'll find a lot of literature, and you don't find that as much on whitetails, you know, even though they're as popular, they generate more license revenue than turkey hunting down here. But you get to looking at the amount of people that put more effort into the game, you know, the hunting of the turkey, and you'll find people trying to put words to the interaction and put words to the connection they feel with the, you know, and the challenge that they experience with their with the game that they're pursuing. And you see a lot of literature around turkeys because I believe people are constantly trying to put a description that does it justice. And I'm not sure anybody ever has, but you look at people that are Colonel Tom Kelly, you know, Gene Nunnery, you've got some authors out there that have done a really good job of trying and putting pen to paper to kind of document the feelings and the emotions that this stuff evokes. And you don't find that with anything else. So the Southeast, I guess, is your short answer, is turkeys are as close to second on in the pecking order as anywhere in the country.
Are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions?
Sure.
Hardest call to do, easiest call to do.
That's all going to be it's going to be up to the individual, but the most difficult call for most people is like kind of like a cluck and purr. It takes a fluttering of the tongue or a gargling of the throat on a mouth call that causes that little bubbly sound, and that's typically harder for people to accomplish. The easiest call, it's the easiest and the hardest, and I'll explain what I mean by that. A yelp is probably the one that people start off with. Typically, they'll pick up a box call or a pot call, and they can mimic that call well enough, easier. But in my opinion, when it comes to judging a turkey sound, it's harder to fool my ears with a turkey yelp. Like, very few people in the country can yelp on a call and me hear it and go, that's a turkey, and it not be a turkey. So it's the easiest to kind of come, you know, to make, but it's the most difficult, in my opinion, to actually be realistic.
Has anyone ever entered an actual turkey into a turkey hall, turkey calling competition? And where do you think the actual turkey would place?
If the turkey didn't win, you've got a problem with judges. Because no matter how hard we try and how much we practice and all the little knickknacks that we gather to try to replicate the sounds, we still have so far to go. I mean, if we still have so far to go, I mean, you can listen to the most accomplished, polished callers in the country and you can put them beside a wild turkey and man, it's not even close. So there's a lot of room for improvement there. So yes, will a wild turkey win? He better, or she better. But no, I don't know if anybody's ever done that. It's just going to be hard to get your hands on one and make them talk when you want them speak when they're spoken to. So.
Yeah, that's true. I'm always reminded of the thing that Groucho Marx, that famous comedian, took third in a Groucho Marx lookalike competition. It's always made me laugh. All right, man. Feet to the fire. You got to pick a state. Best place for hunting. Best place for turkey hunting.
Best place for turkey hunting. It's gotta be hard to beat Georgia and Alabama because opportunity or bag limits are available here. I think you can still kill four in Alabama, even though it went through a reduction. You used to be able to kill three in Georgia. They went to a reduction. You can only kill two now because, like I mentioned earlier, hunters are the first ones to start pulling back on the reins when it's necessary. But we have long seasons. Your seasons are 40 days, 45 days. So the opportunity to get out there for that amount of time, I don't think you can find that anywhere else in the country.
Can you do other calls, right? Like, are you good? Could you just go into duck calling and knock it out like a pro?
Yeah, well, maybe not like a pro, but I've been one of those. Even when I was young, I was just one of those kids that could hear a sound and replicate it and get pretty doggone close with just a little bit of practice. Duck calling, goose calling. Elk, even though I've only hunted elk a handful of times, it's a lot of it goes hand in hand with the mouth reeds, the diaphragms that you use in turkey calling. But yeah, I've always been one of those guys and they could just hear something and replicate it pretty quickly.
Is there a rivalry between turkey and duck callers?
Like, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. It's such a different avenue, I guess. I mean, because with duck calling competitions, they're there to typically showcase the ability of the call as much as they are the ability of the caller. Where with turkey hunting and turkey calling, it's all about, being the turkey. They're there to replicate the sounds of the intended animal. So they're not thinking about the call. They're not there to showcase the call. They don't care what kind of call it is. So that's kind of two totally different deals there.
Best turkey call to start out with. Best like second turkey call, like the
easiest. When you start out, it's going to be with like something like a push pin or a box call, which is a friction type call, typically made out of wood. It's very easy to get a sound out of, and with just a little bit of practice and even some instructions off the paper that comes with the call, you can usually get something that's going to somewhat replicate a turkey. I quickly encourage, and most people do, they'll pick up a mouth diaphragm pretty quickly just because of the necessity. Like I say, turkeys live and die with their eyes. So if you can imagine trying to get a turkey into 40 yards or less running something that you have to actually move to make the sounds, can be a conflict. You can't sit there and call to the turkey with him looking at you and making the movements because he's going to know that it's not a real turkey and he's going to flee. So that's why you use the mouth diaphragms that you can, you have a face mask on, so you have it pulled up to here. So you can still call with a mouth diaphragm in your mouth and the turkey can't see it. So typically that's the second call everybody's going to pick up just due to the necessity of being able to continue to coax the turkey into that close range and him not be able to see any movement.
So tell me about the Pinhoti Project. When did you start that? What's kind of the mission?
Pinhoti Project started in 2018. It was just to produce turkey hunting content. It was to give turkey hunters like myself something that to watch that they could relate to. We all get kind of amped about this time of year when turkey seasons are knocking on the door. Everybody wants to kind of live through somebody else, live vicariously, relive hunts and that kind of thing. And with the popularity of like digital media and YouTube and these different streaming platforms, we saw the opportunity to hop in there and provide something that we felt like was tasteful and kind of illustrated how we turkey hunted and just the cool factor of turkey hunting, making it popular again, making people care about turkeys. Just saw the opportunity to make all of that something. So that's kind of why we hopped in, and here we are.
White meat or dark meat?
Oh man, it's hard to choose. You can't beat turkey breast. Everybody likes turkey breast, right? But if you know how to prepare turkey legs and thighs, they are extremely good. We make turkey tacos and turkey pot pie. We make we actually had turkey enchiladas night before last. Make a lot of stuff with the turkey legs and the dark meat. So it's hard to beat. You shouldn't throw any of it away, I promise you.
That's pretty much all the questions I got, man. Is there anything else you think we missed, or what's kind of coming up next for you?
Oh, next for me, it's the busy season for me. It's essentially turkey season. We're planning where we're going this next spring. I have turkey content. I still have, I typically turkey hunt in the neighborhood of 90 to 95 days a year, and everything's videoed. If I'm awake, unfortunately, when I signed up for the Penhodie Project, I made a promise that I was going to video and document every single thing. And it's kind of what I'm doing now is we produce and I try to get that as much of that content out there real time. Typically, that's only about 15, 17 episodes during the spring season, because as you can imagine, trying to document everything, hunt, if it's daylight, we're hunting, if we're legally allowed to, and then also having time to edit, which is an extremely strenuous and time consuming process. You can't only do so much of that when you're doing it all at the same time. So we have a ton of footage that after the season is over that we're just sitting on, and all off season, I am cleaning that footage up, coming out with episodes so that right here before the season, like I mentioned, when everybody's ramping up and getting excited, wanting to live some hunts from last year, I have a lot of that content available, and that's what we're doing now. I had about 2 months of content that I had to clean up, and I've been nose to the grindstone now for, gosh, next to 2 months to get this stuff cleaned up. So we're down to about 3 weeks left of footage, and so I had to power it down to get on this call with you. So it's busy.
I want to thank Dave so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, learn more about the Penhodie Project, we have linked to him on our social media sites. We're Profoundly Pointless on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram, and we've also included his information in the episode description. Real quick, I want to take a second and thank one of the sponsors of this show, BetterHelp. We've all had times where we don't feel like ourselves. What really helps me is either getting outside, doing something active, or talking to somebody. Because when we're at our best, we can really show up and perform at the highest level. Working with a therapist can help get you closer to that best version of you. Because when you feel empowered, you're more prepared to take on everything that life throws at you. I have had a number of people in my life that have gotten therapy, and it has really turned things around. It has helped them out so much in so many ways. It's helpful to get those positive coping skills, set boundaries, empowers you. So if you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp can be a great option. It's convenient, flexible, affordable, and entirely online. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/pointless today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pointless for 10% off your first month. Okay, now let's bring in John Shull and get to the pointless part of the show. What animal do you think that you can mimic the best? Like, what animal sound can you make the best?
A cow.
Okay. Can you do it for us?
Moo.
That's not good at all.
Moo? I don't, I mean, I guess not. Oh, that was actually quite well.
That's a cow. Have you ever seen a cow?
Yeah.
Or listened to a cow actually moo?
Moo.
No.
Wow.
I'm from Kansas, and it was actually a thing that you would have people that would, you'd see people driving down the highway. They would stop and like take a picture of a cow like they'd never seen one before. It was incredible for people to see like cows.
In Kansas?
No, people traveling through.
Oh, they would just stop, yeah. I can't figure out what I want to do with my hat. I don't know, understand.
I don't understand why you're dressed like Kristoff from Frozen.
I actually really like this sweater, and it is, I don't know, 10 degrees outside, so it's getting worn.
Do you still dress yourself?
Yeah.
Or are most of your purchases, most things either given to you or selected for you? You pick out your own clothes still?
Oh, no. Things are selected or given to me. I just decide when to wear them.
Hmm. Yeah. That's basically the only clothing responsibilities I still have left, is deciding at what point I will wear clothing.
What is your most not wanted to put on item of clothing? Like, do you not want to put on your socks? Putting on your shirt stinks?
Jeans. I hate putting on jeans. I have a pathological hatred of jeans, and always have since I was in second grade and my mom forced me to wear a pair of jeans that I didn't want to wear, and I have hated wearing jeans ever since. Always disliked it.
Were they skinny jeans?
No, but they were like black acid wash, I think. Like, I just hated them. But that's what I had to wear. I believe I cried at the Olive Garden, to get specific about it.
Of course you did. All right, now I'm curious. Is that the worst public place you've ever shed a tear in?
Yeah, crying at the Olive Garden as a child. That would be my most embarrassing, probably. Or my most, like, public meltdown. Where would you say, besides just being drunk and you don't remember it, where would you say is your greatest public shaming?
Oh,
where did it happen for you?
It's easy for me. I was, I don't remember the age. I was a younger kid, maybe 6, 7, 8, or 9, but it was on a T-ball field and my dad was the coach. And I remember I wasn't doing well pitching. So I started crying on the mound, and he came out to the mound and basically berated me and told me how big of a failure I was and walked me to the dugout and said, I'll never play baseball again.
Did you?
Yeah, actually. Yep.
Well, then you triumphed over adversity. I went to Olive Garden again later on in my life, but I always remember Olive Garden associated with jeans.
Listen,
and crying into my breadsticks.
No offense to Olive Garden, because I know they're a big sponsor of the show. I don't like food that I can go to a restaurant that I can make in my own kitchen, whether it's good enough or not, but that I feel is good enough or as good as like Olive Garden or something like that.
I've always felt that Italian food is a dinner-only type of food. Even pizza, I don't generally want to eat pizza for lunch, unless it's leftover pizza. But I wouldn't ever order a pizza for lunch. I believe firmly that Italian food is a dinner food. I would also say the same with Mexican food, to be honest with you.
I give you Italian food maybe, just because most of it's heavy and carby and you just want to go to sleep after. But Mexican food, nothing wrong with grabbing some Taco Bell in between work days and going back, shitting your brains out.
The problem is I eat too much of it. Right, any food that I'm going to really go after, I don't want to eat for lunch. Buffet, lunch buffet. Somebody goes to a lunch buffet, they're calling it a day.
Man. You know, we haven't had the buffet conversation in a while. I think the last time we talked about it was when COVID was kind of at its peak and we're like, oh man, buffets are over. But I don't think buffets have come back. I think they may be dead.
I think so too. I don't know. You don't see a lot of places that have a buffet. Yeah.
Though, looking back on it, buffet food is kind of disgusting.
Okay, so is really the only animal you can imitate is a cow? That was terrible. What else? Do you have any other animals that you could do like an animal sound?
Nay! Meow!
Are you just not very good at making sounds in general?
I mean, I'm like...
Or like...
All right. All right.
Give me a real effort. Give me a horse, give me a dog, and give me a cow. Fine. Give me some real effort here.
I'm gonna try. Here goes a horse.
Nay.
It's terrible.
It is terrible. Yeah. It's terrible. What else you want to hear? You want to hear a dog? Well, here's a dog.
Roof, roof. Roof, roof.
Terrible.
What's the last one you wanted to hear?
Cat. Come on. You got to be able to do a cat very well.
Meow.
Oh, my God. It's terrible.
It's hard, man. Listen, meow. That is one thing that I don't think people get enough credit for. If you can make sounds or like a comedian, you know, what's that one guy that that was in the Police Academy.
Yeah. Nobody knows what his name is, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I think
everybody knows him as the guy in Police Academy. Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm not good at making sounds. I'm just not.
There, Michael Winslow. I'm going to say Michael Winslow. That could be completely wrong, but I feel like Winslow is in there somewhere. That's a person that was famous for doing something that there was never any part two to him. He never had a successor. Like, who's the famous guy who can do a lot of sounds right now? There really isn't anybody.
Oh, I'm sure they're out there. We just aren't educated enough to know, I'm sure.
But not famous. Not someone that would be like, oh, yeah, that's the guy who makes all those sounds. Or even people who do impressions. There was the guy, Frank Caliendo, was his name, that did a lot of impressions.
Yeah.
Those come and go like every 10 years. There's not a lot of people who can do a lot of them. It's hard.
Well, I mean, SNL kind of at least is the American pinnacle, right? I mean, that's kind of where you go if you're top notch, even though Pete Davidson's been on there for a decade now. But
oh, you know what I was going to ask you? How did you take the bad news this week?
I mean, it wasn't bad. I mean, it.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Probably not. So what are you referring to?
I don't know how you couldn't know this. Are you the outlaw candle connoisseur?
I am. What was the bad?
Then why do you not know that Bed Bath & Beyond is filing for bankruptcy and they're going to close down all their stores? What are you going to do when you can't go to Bed Bath & Beyond?
It's fine. I appreciate them, and I still think their product lineup will still be around. Maybe just not in brick and mortar stores, but regardless, then we just move on. The outlaw doesn't stop. He breaks hearts, cashes checks, and breaks necks. You know what I mean? He doesn't stop for one candle.
Well, when it comes to candles, that's the kind of lifestyle you have to live. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, let's give some shout-outs. I picked some easy ones here, so let's get to them. All right, Sophia Bazell, Harry Calder, Joel Moore, Michael Zawatch, Robbie Wilson, Grace Barrett, Maddox Bowers. I didn't realize how much I actually liked the name Maddox till I just saw that person's handle.
Grows on you a little bit.
Yeah,
solid.
Yeah. Kaysen Hominy, Thomas Darland, and Jonathan Colon, or Jonathan Colon. I'm not entirely sure, but we're going to.
Well, how do you spell it?
It's C-O-L-O-N.
Well, that's colon. Cologne would be C-O-L-O-G-N-E.
I'm pretty sure his last name is not colon.
There's got to be. It's probably like, what if it's... What? If his name is colon and he had a stepbrother, would that be a semicolon?
Oh, boy. How old are you? 45, 50?
That's a great joke. Go fuck yourself. That was brilliant. I'm not going to be lectured by a guy who's dressed like Kristoff, okay?
As we look towards the future here, I got a couple of bangers for you. What are you more likely to purchase, you think? A self-driving car or a do-it-itself robot?
Do-it-itself what? What's it doing?
I mean, whatever. Chores can...
Well, couldn't I just have the robot drive the car? So there, knocked out two birds with one stone right there.
No, you can't. You have to pick one or the other. All right? Don't be that guy.
If it's a do-it-yourself robot, why can't I just have it drive the car?
Okay, fine. Then I'll ask this question, smartass. Would you trust the robot to drive you?
Yeah. I trust... Look, whenever there's a thing where it's like, oh, it's handmade. Well, I'd rather not have that. I want something that's made by robots. I trust robots far more than I trust people. I don't want something handmade. I want it made by a robot. The robot did it right.
Yeah, I don't know. I, I, I'm not saying that the accuracy and precision isn't 100% with robots, because it probably is. But the human error, the human element to things, and I go back to baseball, and I know you hate that sport in general, but it's like they want to have robot umpires.
Yeah, they should. They would get the calls correct.
But human error is part of life. It's what, you know, it's what makes it somewhat exciting sometimes.
Yeah, I don't really feel that way when it comes to like cars or things that I'm trusting with my life with.
Yeah, well, that's
I'd much rather have it done by something that's going to get it correct.
Nah.
Look, I get the idea of handmade and you can have something special and it's crafted and all those kind of things. But if it's something that's like not in that situation, I would much rather have it made by a robot.
Yeah. I wouldn't.
It's hard to duplicate people, man. We do a lot of stuff that's very difficult.
The 5-second rule, you okay with that? Can it go to 10 seconds? If you drop something on the floor, is it automatically ruined? What's your rule of thumb when it comes to that 5-second rule?
Depends what the consistency is of the thing, right? And depends on my location. If I'm in my house, as far as I'm concerned, the 5-second rule doesn't apply. I'll eat something off the floor the next day. I don't have a problem with that. As long as it hasn't gone stale, if there's like some popcorn on the floor, I'm like, I'm going to pick it up and probably eat it. If we're in a restaurant setting, I'm okay with it. The thing that I've always found to be a little bit gross is when people put food, like if they're eating a hamburger or a sandwich or something like that, and they put the food down on the tabletop. I've always thought that was kind of gross. Like, oh, you don't want to do that. I'm okay with the 5-second rule. I'm actually okay with the 5-second rule outside more than I am inside. Oh, it's got a little dirt on it. Well, at least I know what that dirt just is. It's just dirt, most likely. But if it's inside, like, I don't know what kind of cleaners are being mixed on it, what kind of person is like walked dog shit across the floor. I'd rather eat outside.
I mean, I'm kind of a big believer in, you know, say you drop something even on a public bathroom floor, I might eat it. I mean,
I wouldn't.
It all depends to
off
me.
You can't off the bathroom floor?
Yeah, I mean, I know there's bacteria and I know there's germs, but I mean, think about every door handle you touch per day, or the average person, whatever. Maybe not just you. Or you go to the grocery store and you touch the cart, or, you know, just things like that. How many germs are on that? And then you touch your eyes, you touch your mouth, touch your private parts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why are you eating in the bathroom in the first place?
I'm not.
Do you regularly eat in the bathroom?
Actually, at work, that's where I go on my break. I go to the big stall and I just sit there and eat my lunch.
Do you really?
No, man.
Maybe you wanted some privacy. You got to have some alone time. Get some privacy. Get some work done. Cry a little. I could see that.
No, but I've never done that. And I don't think if you do that, if you're out there listening to this and that's your escape from your job for a half an hour, 45 minutes a day is to hang out in the stall, then you do you, man, or woman.
Will you eat in the bathroom at your house, though? Like, will you go into the bathroom with something to eat? Finger food, obviously, we're talking about here.
I mean, no, but I guess that's just because I don't. Would I? Yes, I would. I would eat.
I'll generally, like, I'm okay with eating while standing up, but if I'm sitting down, I'm probably not eating something. I feel like that's a little bit too mixing stuff.
I mean, I'd eat things off my bathroom floor for sure. Even the next day, I do it.
Good. I agree. I wouldn't eat stuff if it like fell in the corner, though. If it's in the corner, I'm probably not going to eat it. Needs to be somewhere towards the middle of the floor.
I'll eat the corner. I'll eat anything. All right. Let's see here. So our four choices this week of things that our listeners voted on. Actually, quite a few votes, which is pretty nice. So Damar Hamlin, that was one of them. Obviously, the Buffalo Bills safety who died on the field, had CP.
He didn't die. He's alive. You know he's alive, right?
I looked this up. He was legally dead. His heart stopped. He needed to be resuscitated. and it took them longer than 10 minutes to get his heart back pumping. He was legally dead on a football field.
Is that, well, I mean, yeah, okay, but that's one of those things that if you told a room full of people, and like, if you wrote that answer on a test, you were like, well, he died on the field. They'd be like, you got that one wrong, right? I understand that you're technically correct, but you're also wrong.
So he didn't die. So what do you say then? Well, I mean, what would you classify it? That he had a cardiovascular...
Had to be hospitalized. He was taken to the hospital and he collapsed on the field and was taken to the hospital in critical condition. Or you could say he nearly died.
Yeah, well, either way.
Right. It's like the thing with electrocution, right? Like, I was electrocuted. No, you weren't. Technically, to be electrocuted, you have to die.
Yes.
But everybody uses it in a different way. One of my first bosses used to say, it doesn't matter if the car is red. If everybody thinks it's blue, you're the idiot.
I mean, that's not necessarily incorrect.
Right. Popular opinion does ultimately win out. It changes the language.
It does.
You're the one who's wrong, even if you're right.
Anyways. All right. So there's that. Another choice was, do you remember, and you probably don't, the gif of the kid that was eating Popeyes? He's a little African-American boy. He's holding a big soda, and, you know, someone asks him a question, and he just sits there with a really blank stare on his face, and he moves his eyes, like, left to right. It's one of the more famous gifs of all time.
I do not remember it.
Let me see.
Maybe, I bet I would remember it aside from the Popeyes reference.
Well, I mean, that's...
I mean, I have the internet, okay.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what it was known for, was because... Like, all right, here it is.
He had Popeyes?
Here it is.
Popeyes got some good biscuits
there.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that kid was eating Popeyes.
Yes.
I just didn't realize he had... Well, okay, what about him?
So, he's back in the headlines because he is now a very good college football player. And he's being recruited by, you know, a lot of major schools. And for one, it makes me feel old as hell that gif is almost a decade old. And two... sign the kid, all right? He obviously has a charisma, and he's made for stardom. So, anyways, third choice is Prince Harry. Kind of crazy what came out, you know, in the multiple interviews that he's doing now.
I don't know anything about that, but I know that there is some drama that is unfolding there. It's getting to that level of drama reminds me of the drama surrounding the film Don't Worry, Darling, where even though you had no interest in it and no interest in that kind of discussion, it's getting to the point now where you're starting to be like, what's happening here?
Right.
You're hearing a noise that eventually is becoming, that's going to become so loud and pervasive, you got to go see what it is.
Well, and we've talked about this before, about the royal family, and it was only a matter of time before the current times caught up with the family. And I think that's what's happening with, you know, Harry and Meghan's exile.
Wait a minute. So what team are you on? What side are you on? You on team Harry or team other guy?
I'm on
Charles. William.
Yeah.
William.
I'm on team William just because I think it's still remarkable, you know, just the tradition that revolves around the royal family. Now, we're not English citizens or under the monarchy, but, you know, from an outsider's point of view, it's pretty incredible to me that they've maintained power or whatever you want, influence. And now you have the redheaded stepchild who's coming out and saying all these things about how terrible it was. And that's fascinating as well.
It's always interesting to see, like, well, who's right? Who's telling the truth?
Yeah, I mean,
whose version of the events is actually the real one, right? Like, is he being a little bit overdramatic and is trying to sensationalize things? I would say somebody that consistently has really no source of income other than being a royal family member needs to generate some kind of controversy around himself, right? So there's probably a little bit of gamesmanship going on there. But how much of that is really true?
Well, I mean,
really true.
We
just spent 5 minutes talking about William and Harry.
I know. All right. And so the thing that the topic that actually won is a football topic. It happened last night between the Packers and Lions. Getting down towards the end of the game, Quay Walker, a rookie linebacker for the Green Bay Packers, was involved. He's the star of this terrible incident. But essentially what happened, Detroit line player goes down. Trainers are coming out to help him. Quay Walker's kind of near the scene. Detroit Lions trainer tries to get to DeAndre Swift, the Hurt Lion, and Walker shoves him for no reason. And then another Packer kind of like bows up to the trainer and like, you know, hits him with his chest. And it's like, for one, how dumb are you? And then he's crying as he's getting ejected, even though he's only 21 or 22. But they just had the DeMar Hamlin incident where trainers saved this guy's life. And then less than a week later, you do something like that. Like, he should be gone. I'd ban him for his entire life if I could.
I saw this happen, and my reaction as it, as someone who's not intimately tied to Detroit and support everything Detroit, no matter what is actually happening, I saw it and was like, that really doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
You're insane.
I mean,
you are gaslighting the shit out of this.
First of all, it's not that big of a shove, right? Okay, he pushes the person a little bit, right? But was any who had to be taken to the hospital?
Nobody. Okay, that
it doesn't look like that big of a deal. It's like, okay.
I mean,
let's move on.
You were in media for a long time. You're on the sidelines, watching the game, reporting, whatever, minding your own business. Next thing you know, someone comes up and shoves you. I mean, that's ridiculous.
The guy kind of came in there a little bit.
Oh, my God.
Right? Like, the athletic trainer came in there a little hot, had to be kind of a tough guy. Right? I don't think it's that big of a deal.
Okay.
I looked at it and was like, all right, he shouldn't have done that, but let's not make this into the biggest incident in the world, right? It's not like he hauled off and just punched the guy in the face. He pushed him.
Okay. All right.
Right?
So let me – I feel like you're just baiting me here, but I'll take the bait.
No, I really don't think it was that big of a deal. Like, all right, I get it. Kick him out of the game. Fine him. Suspend him. Like, it's –
But even if you know, the push wasn't what you say it is, and I agree. I mean, the guy could have laid him out, right? He's a professional football player. He's way bigger, way stronger, whatever. It's not the point.
Like, the guy didn't even fall down. It's not like he even pushed him over.
He's trying to get to his hurt comrade over there.
He could have went the up. Like, first of all, he came in a little bit hot and heavy.
Listen.
Like, nobody. Okay, this is what I would say. This is why I feel the way that I do. Nobody in that situation needed to handle it the way that they did.
I don't know what the trainer did. He was just trying to get to the pile, to get to the player.
Look, I'm an unbiased person. You're obviously very biased.
I am, and you know what? I'm going to say this, and I hope that this infuriates at least one person listening right now, and that is that the Green Bay Packers fan base, they're the worst fans in all the professional sports, except for the New York Yankees fans.
See, you're taking it personally. I don't take it personally.
And Boston.
I look at the incident on its face value, which looks like one guy kind of pushed the football player out of the way, and the football player kind of pushed him back a little bit. Are you ready for our top five? Can we move on to something important?
I guess.
Something truly important?
I'm not going to be very kind to my top five, though.
All right. Well, our top five is the top five birds. And we're not getting into the certain subspecies of birds here. We're talking about the overall type of bird, broad categories of bird. I don't want to hear about, like, the northern reticulated woodpecker.
Ooh.
Sounds pretty sweet. I think I actually just made that up, but it might be a real thing.
How's that? Is that a good woodpecker?
Not at all.
Oh. All right.
Have you ever heard of woodpeckers? Like,
oh, there you go.
They go fast, man.
I actually can't.
Yeah, you can. You.
I can't.
Woodpecker's pretty unmistakable.
So. I can't roll my tongue, so.
You can't roll your tongue?
Nope.
I don't know. What do you mean you can't roll
your tongue? You just rolled your tongue, yeah.
You can't do that?
No, I can't.
Can you curl your tongue? Apparently, it's like a genetic thing.
That?
Oh, God. Is that your... Oh. I don't ever want to see another man's tongue. Oh, my God. Do you have a huge tongue? What are you doing
it is,
over
it
there?
It is pretty big, isn't it?
You can't do this? Mm-hmm. Oh, you can do that.
Okay. Are we two grown-ass men curling their tongues at each other right now?
This is interesting to see what people can do. Okay. All right, so what's your number five on the list of top five best birds?
I'm going to go, my number five is a duck.
A duck?
Yeah, a duck.
I understand the... I don't know if duck should be in top five. It's a great word to say. Duck, it may be like the funniest and best named bird.
No.
Like, everybody likes to say duck.
No.
But I don't think it's... I'd have a hard time putting it in my top... No, I could put it in my top 10. I'd put it probably like number 8.
Ducks made the list for three reasons. You can eat them. They're awesome to look at. They're cool. They're fun. And you can have them as pets.
There is something slightly enjoyable about a duck. Everybody does like a duck. Okay, I wouldn't put it in my top five, but I would have to agree that everybody does like a duck in general.
Everybody.
Nobody's like, oh, ducks, get them out of here. Even if they piss you off, you're still like, can't get rid of the ducks, man. You got to have ducks. Mm-hmm. My number five is a crow. That's the only bird that I'm afraid of. Those things might be smarter than us. Like, I'm not entirely sure that one day the crows aren't going to make a plot to take us out. It's out of respect. Out of respect that I put a crow at number five.
I have a similar bird a little bit higher on my list, so I will refrain until we get up there. My number four, I have the eagle.
Mm. If it wasn't America's bird, our national bird or whatever that we're supposed to recall it,
mm-hmm.
our national animal. Is it our national animal or is it just our national bird?
I think it's the national animal. I think. Should we know this?
I feel like we should. Is it just the national bird or is it our
It's,
national animal?
Yeah, it's it's the I don't know. It's the founding fathers made the choice when they selected the bald eagle as the emblem of the nation.
It should honestly be, if we were going to have, what would you think that our national animal would be if it wasn't a bird?
Hmm.
Like, okay, no, this is just the bird, but what's the national animal?
I mean, the thing is America, I mean, I don't know, right? Because you don't really have one animal that is in every part of the country, other than, you know, ants and bees and things. Like, maybe...
Technically an insect. I don't know if an insect is an animal. I don't know the classification there. We probably shouldn't get it.
Yeah.
Here's what I think it should be, and here's what I think we would pick. I think it should probably be the cow. Like, that is, in some ways, a symbol of America.
Okay.
But I could go with a bear. Like, that's tough enough, right? Like, you can't have a cow as your symbol, but the bear I could go with.
Yeah, I mean...
Or a bison.
I think...
No, just a bear.
The bison would be good, I think, actually. Bison. But I think a bear is more more realistic.
Yeah, because no country would be like... Like, I think that there was some famous person from long ago that wanted to put the turkey up there as, like, the national animal, and they all shot him down. I think it was Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah.
That would be the same as having the cow. You got to go with, like, the bear. Okay. I mean, eagle just doesn't do a, like, all right. Man, there it is. It's cool to see one, though. There's some bald eagles out here in Seattle. My number four is a hummingbird. Always enjoyable to see a hummingbird. See them in the morning, see them at night. Always good time to see a hummingbird.
Meh.
You got a meh hummingbird?
Yeah, I mean... They don't, you know, once again, they don't do anything for me. I don't really, you know, they don't stick around long enough. They're too little. All they're known
for. You don't really get a good look at them. I would say that. You don't really get a good look at them very much.
Yeah, you don't, which is bullshit.
Okay. What's your number three?
A hawk.
Ooh, I have hawk as my number three, tied with owl.
Okay. Well, I kind of like what you were saying about the crow. Hawk is, and we have some of them in the flat, I mean, we both live in residential areas, and there are hawks in my area that will pick things up and murder them in your yard, and all that is left is just a pile of feathers. from whatever this hawk destroyed.
They're vicious.
Yeah, they are vicious.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if really, if you think about it, an owl is basically just a nighttime hawk. It's just hunting during the night instead of a hawk that's hunting during the day.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of owls, I guess. I don't really even understand what they do. Like how do they...
They're basically a nighttime hawk. They do what the hawk does, except they do it at night. Eating small other animals. They're cool, man. Like, it's kind of a treat to see an owl. You don't see them a lot. It's a very unmistakable, ooh, can you give me an ant? See if you can do a, see if you can do a hawk or an owl. That's not bad, actually. That's your best one.
I appreciate that.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
ooh, ooh, ooh, ooh.
That wasn't, you're getting more, you just, you should, we should move on.
All right.
All right, what's your number two?
An ostrich.
I get it, but I don't get it.
I mean,
like, it's an impressive bird, but like, what are you going to do with it? Like, it's not pretty to look at. It's not really that cool.
I get what you're saying, but I think ostriches are far more versatile than we give them credit for. Not only are they, I believe they're the fastest land bird. You can also ride them. They're mean as hell, so you know they're going to protect you. Very versatile birds.
Can't really domesticate them, though. And, like, do you really want to hang around with an ostrich?
I mean, sure. Why not? I'd probably rather hang around an ostrich than a hawk.
Yeah, that's true. I'd much rather have a hawk. No, I'd much rather have an ostrich friend than a hawk. You couldn't trust the hawk.
No, no.
The ostrich, I feel like, would be more loyal. My number two is a penguin.
Okay. I left the penguin off just because I'm tired of penguins. I'm tired of them.
I think that that's a huge amount of bias coming through, and that you need, the penguin has to be on the top five list. Even if you hate penguins, you have to acknowledge the greatness of penguins.
If anything, I would put them as a tie for number five, but they are going no higher than number five.
Okay. What's your number one then?
It's probably, we probably have the same number one, because I think there is just one overall bird. So my number one is the chicken.
My number one is the chicken as well. I wondered if you had, right? I think when you get down to it, it has to be the chicken. I could give, like, I think some people might go penguin. Some people would go cardinal or, like, one of the brightly colored birds, like a toucan. But the chicken has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be the best bird.
I mean, it's.
Chicken.
Name me another animal outside of, what, a cow? That is more wild, and I probably sound pretty dumb here, but I mean, what other animal gets eaten as much as a chicken? I mean, that alone makes it number one, the number one bird.
It has to be chicken, right? Even though it's not a pretty bird, it's not like really a good pet or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's old reliable. It's your friend.
Yeah, well, so is Old Yeller.
Okay, what's on your honorable mention?
I mean, these, I don't know. I just put these on there because they're favorites of mine, but let's see. So I have a blue jay, a toucan. That's kind of it. I mean, I put penguin on the list, but like, yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty confident in my top five.
You know, like, to me, the blue jay, the cardinal, the robin, all of those kind of similar-sized birds, like, all right, I get it. Cardinal, I think, is the best of those kind of birds. Maybe the robin next. Yeah, there's a lot of other ones, but they all kind of fit in the same thing.
I mean, what are...
Condor.
I mean, pelicans. I think pelicans, I mean, they serve a purpose, right?
That's got to be the one of the worst birds. Like... Who's the worst bird for you? Pigeon or seagull?
Oof, that's tough, man. I'm going to go seagull, but only because I've had more run-ins with seagulls and negative experiences.
What kind of run-ins have you had with seagulls?
Well, at least twice in my life, they have taken food away from me at, you know, once was at a park. And once was at a theme park.
How old were you when you lost food to the seagull?
Theme park, I was a teen. And at the park, I was an adult.
How'd they get it? Did they take it right out of your hand?
The theme park, they did. There was two of them. At the park, it waited basically till I went up to throw something away in a trash bin, and then it hopped on and stole my hamburger.
You can't leave that unattended.
It's pathetic.
Did you get any bites of it, or did they get it before?
Yeah, I had a couple bites, but it was more the principle of the thing of...
Was it good?
Yeah, it's a...
A scale of 1 to 10, how good was the hamburger before you got it stolen by a seagull?
It was like a 7. I don't even remember the name of the place. It was on Lake Eola.
I bet that was expensive, too.
It was. But I was...
You're getting a hamburger by the water. You're probably paying... Do you think you paid as much as $20? I think that seagull owes you a 20?
Seagull's probably dead, so I think I made out in the end.
Have you ever been defeated by any other animals?
Defeated?
You were defeated, right? It's okay to be defeated by animals. I've lost some fights to animals.
Outside of a dog, not really. I mean, I got bit by a snake once, but that wasn't... It's a little bitty snake.
That hurt?
No, it was a little bitty snake. It was, it's not even a cool story to tell, really. Yeah. No, not really. I haven't really had that many run-ins with animals that I can think of,
Man, I've never had my food stolen by a bird.
Well, I think you...
It's interesting to me for some reason.
You need to get on
it. I've been attacked by a bird.
I think you need to get on it, man.
I got to put myself in more dangerous situations. Live your life out there. Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, leave us a review, subscribe, rating, all that stuff. We really appreciate it. It really does help out the show. And let us know what you think are some of the best birds. I know that we said chicken, but after listening to Dave and how impressive of an animal a turkey is, I might have to start creeping that up the list. It's not on my top 5 yet, but I would say that it's entered my top 10 where it hasn't before. But let us know what you think are some of the best birds.